Masters.
Today we are joined by a very special guest, Ms. Ashton Berry. She's at The Collectress on Instagram. She also does work through Radical Exchange and has an awesome event coming up called Resistance Served, which actually by the time this airs, maybe when is Resistance Served?
February 2nd through the 5th.
Wonderful. So hopefully if you're hearing this, you can go because it is, where's it at again?
It's in New Orleans.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So we're here with Ashton and we're going to talk about the wine that we are drinking first because of course we're drinking wine and then we're going to get into what I think is going to be a really important conversation.
Yeah, it's a beautiful rainy day here in Los Angeles and we're drinking rosé.
Yeah.
Because... why not?
Yeah.
It's
Adam knows about this one.
Yeah,
too.
It's a Take wine it called Advinum by a guy named Sebastian Chatillon or Seb to his friends. He was a Somme sommelier at Chateaubriand in Paris for like 7 or 8 years, and then moved to the Rhone and started making wine. And I don't think it's been that many years, maybe 3 or 4, maybe around.
Wow.
And
what
he makes. Yeah. He was a protege of René Mauss.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So, ooh, Domaine Mauss?
Domaine Mauss?
Or, yeah, Mosse?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the one with the two hot sons?
Yeah, well, he was...
Super babes.
He's not...
I see that pretty much on every podcast. Yeah. Like, most people are hot.
At least that's where I think he learned his winemaking.
Cool.
And this is his rosé, Levat, L-E-V-A-T. And it's really dark. I'd like this is Tavel rosé. This is almost. I barely would call this a rosé, to be honest.
Yeah, it's like a really like dark. It's very cherry colored. Like it's mm-hmm. It's like exactly what I would think of. Like you know, legit cherries from a tree. Like the ones with the darker
it looks
skin.
Like beet juice.
Yeah, like beet juice. Yeah, it's but it's and it's rich. It's actually like kind of a perfect winter rosé.
It is. I agree with that.
Yeah, it's really nice. It is kind of high in alcohol. But, you know, it's chilly out. We got sweaters on in Los Angeles, so I'm here for it.
Yeah, Marissa was, when I came, and I think when you arrived, all the windows were open, and she was like, I love how cold it is. I was like, I don't.
Yeah, well, you know
what?
My AC doesn't work in the summer. It's fucking cold as fuck here in my house in the winter, whatever. Anyways, the wine's great. I'm digging this one. So, Ashton.
Yeah.
Let's get into a bit about what you do, because you do very, very, very important work.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on kind of the day of the week, but I think most people probably know me from the cocktail world. And I center a lot of conversations around intersectionality and how it should be used as a tool, for us to... basically, introspect and also create businesses that are healthier and more sustainable in terms of like how we treat human beings. But I have a host of different skill sets that have ranged on, you know, trauma care to transformative justice mediation. And so those skill sets have helped me in my ability to do work do this type of work in the industry.
Yeah, and you...
Can I have a question real quick?
Yeah.
Can you define intersectionality?
Yeah, I absolutely do. So intersectionality, really quick click notes, is not new in terms of the essence of what it means, but the term was created by Kimberly Crenshaw as a law critique from University of Chicago Law in 1989. And basically, this is the best way to think about it. There was a case where Black women were suing an automobile company because they felt as if they were being discriminated against. And the law said that they could sue as Black people or as women, but not as Black women, because that was not looked at as a... Yeah. Was
they were not,
not
recognized by the law.
They were not recognized by the law.
Wild.
So they sued as Black people and they lost. And the commentary from the judge was that you aren't being discriminated against because this automobile factor hires Black people. They hire Black men. Look. And then they went back and they sued as women. They said, well... that's not true because they hire women. Look, there are white women that work here. So you're not being discriminated against. And they did not see the Black woman, the intersection of those identities as a unique experience, unique lived experience. It's super important because basically this critique in law has set a foundation for many different groups to be able to fight for their rights to be acknowledged by the law. So when we see people fighting for... specifically the trans community fighting to be seen, this is what they're talking about. The law doesn't recognize you as a unique experience, then you don't legally have rights.
Wow.
So would my intersectionality be a cis, white, straight male?
Yeah, so identities...
I just don't think you count anymore.
No. You definitely count.
I mean, awful human being?
No, you are not a complete awful human being. But yes, like, cis is one of your identities. White is one of your identities.
You don't have to worry about the law, man.
Middle class can be your identity. My identities, I am a cis black woman. And some of our identities are things we're born with. Some of our identities are things we earn. I am also college educated. That is something that I have earned over my my lifetime.
And you went to, and to speak on that too, just to kind of give people a background, you went to University of Chicago.
I did go to University of Chicago.
And studied sociology and economics.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I mean,
we'll say study loosely.
Study, okay. Well, I mean, but I mean, now that, I mean, especially like your work with, you are a socio-political, like, phenom, like, amazing voice in the hospitality world, in my opinion, like, you are doing probably the hardest and most important work in a very vocal and public way, which I really respect. I'm so happy to have you here.
Yeah, I agree. I want to put that on. I was shaking my head, but I was like, oh wait, I don't want people to think that. I agree. I think it's really really important.
And Ashton, though, something that I think gets lost in your narrative sometimes, because you are known publicly. If you don't follow Ashton, I think you need to on Instagram. Every day I'm learning something new from her.
Thank you.
At the Collectress again, but we'll put that in everywhere. You also studied wine, though. You originally studied wine.
I'm
not saying like you didn't like not in
yeah I didn't lose
sociology,
it but like yeah
but,
yeah.
It, but the bartending thing, you initially had gotten in, you were a part of wine or
yeah so wine. I mean, I'm a sommelier masquerading as a bartender. I just really figured out, like, really early on that the glass ceiling was low. You know, right now the wine industry is having this renaissance of women in wine. But as a young black woman that was coming up in Chicago, there were very few opportunities to be mentored, to be educated, and to have access. And so, and also to make a livable wage. Like, let's be honest, I didn't have the privilege of having a support system that would allow me to not make money. I just had to. That's how I kind of got into bartending. I worked at Pops for Champagne for years. And I have 1, 2, and 3 of the W set. My dream before was to be a MW. Maybe one day I'll still do it. But yeah, most people who know me personally know me more as a wine person than a cocktail person.
And you also worked in Champagne, right?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, like, actually in, like, you went and worked in the region.
I mean, I never worked in a region employee, but I've done a harvest in Champagne, which is a privilege and I'm really grateful for.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Recently, or I guess now by the time people are hearing this, it won't be so recent, but by now, I'm sure if you listen to this podcast, you know that I was a part of a New York Times report that came out about sexual assault in the wine industry, which is a huge issue that that Times piece barely scraped the surface of. But something while that was happening, I talked to Adam about this, and I also talked to Ashton about this, on Instagram. I met Ashton through Instagram, and like now we've met in real life, which
like
is
almost all your friends.
Yes, it's truly. One of the things that was really frustrating to me when I was going through this and like collecting stories and working on putting together this, working with the Times, in collaboration with them, was a certain lack of support, in our community. I mean, there was a lot of great support. Like, I feel really grateful that, like, you know, people like men like Adam and, you know, and it obviously supported me, but also too, it was interesting that, it crossed lines that natural versus conventional usually draw. And something that Ashton, you said to me when I was expressing my frustration of like, why does it seem that, why is it that, and this is like a thing that all of us say, I think, in the wine industry, in the natural wine thing, is like, why is it that everyone can be so upset about sulfur, but they can't be upset about sexual assault? Like, why is it that Amex sponsoring Raw is the biggest fucking deal in the world, but like me saying that people are being, that women are being assaulted, you know, there's it's quiet. And you said to me that, and I was like, you know, people need to be mm-hmm. supportive in the community, and they need to have like this sense of like, it doesn't have to be social justice. And you said support in a community is not social justice. Support is making a community sustainable. And that stuck with me, that support is actually sustainability. So I'd love for you to kind of explain that a little bit, because I think it's such a powerful statement, especially in a community where we are so focused on sustainability in every other way.
Right.
But it doesn't seem that we're focused on being sustainable as a community.
Yeah, I mean, we're not. And that's not just the wine community. That's the hospitality industry as a whole. I think that a lot of times we don't realize how much efficiency is driving the way that we operate in our community. And when I say, we have to be really clear that like the commercializing of sustainability is part of the problem, because we're right
and
now.
When you say that, just for like listeners, just,
because I think it can like be hard corporate companies, you know, made it a point to latch on to something that is not new. Like, let's be clear, sustainable practices are not new. And what we do know is that many of the sustainable practices that were here in our country and, you know, all over the globe were generally instituted by indigenous people, right? And with the erasure of them, we also got an erasure of those practices, right? But it also is a conversation about where do we find value and who do we trust to tell us how to take care of spaces. And I think right now we have an issue specifically in our community where we want to always talk about community as long as it doesn't come with ask for accountability with how we engage with one another. And the fact of the matter is that we need systemic ways to take care of each other, and that requires boundaries and accountability. Our wine can only be sustainable if people are sustainable.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's the thing that people seem to forget. It's like wine is only valuable if we are here to value it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And we determine what that value is.
And whether it's farming or whether it's the fact that the winemaker is good to people.
But this is what people always want to separate in. When you said this about like, how do we get people, you know, I think your comment was like, how do we get people to be activists and social justice? And I was like, you don't, and this is where we got to get really clear. If it requires you to be an activist or a social justice advocate to see people's humanity, we have already lost. We are at a detriment, right? But to talk about how we need to care about what's in our wine, but not talk about how we need to care for people who make the wine, is part of the problem. When we take care of people, the other things will start to solve for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is the thing, like, people have said this. This is the thing that I'm saying is not new. But I think in the wine industry, something, and it's not just in the wine industry, and I'm going to say something, you know, people who have never heard me speak before are probably going to be like, this chick's wild. But like,
that's what I like about you.
You know, is that like, I have to say this because I think once you say this and you connect it, it becomes clear to people. Hospitality in America specifically is the third construct of slavery. We always like to talk about how agricultural systems and the inequity of them and the inequity of farming is a derivative of slavery. That's a regular conversation that's always happened in food systems. We always like to talk about the prison industrial complex. What we don't talk about is hospitality. What we don't talk about is this hierarchy that has been here and has stayed here because the laborers were once people who were looked at as cattle and transactional pieces of a structure. And like, some people are going to be like, no, yes. 1865 labor laws literally are why we have the institution of tipping. 1865 labor laws are literally things that mandated codes and certain other things about public spaces, specifically restaurants and bars, and how the people who worked with them could behave.
Yeah, I always find it wild when a server makes more money from tipping that the taxes taken out makes their paycheck zero. Mm-hmm. And that means that your employer just paid you zero.
Right.
For you to work. I've always been like, there's something wrong about that because you're basically working for free. I'm not saying it's slavery, but it's like fucking...
Well, it's not slavery, but you have to remember these laws were instituted to keep black people specifically from amassing wealth, right? You know, 1865 is right after slavery ends. And in, you know, it's not like they didn't know slavery was going to end. Like, they knew slavery was going to end. And so all of these governments, states started passing laws, and before anybody on this is like, that's in the South. No. That's all over the country.
People also forget that California had insane and this is pro-slavery.
People don't ever want to talk about this. And it's like, this is the way that they did that. And one of the ways that they did it was saying, hey, you don't have to pay them a living wage. You can tip them.
And this is
what they did. And it wasn't just for servers, bartender, restaurant bars. It was for all domestic labor.
Well, and think about like that fucking, those memes that we have about like the Karens, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like this meme where it's like the Karen is always the one like, well, I'm not going to fucking tip you. It's like this power struggle that the customer now has. And the customer's like, I have power over you.
Right.
And I am going to tell you why I didn't. Oh, it happens all the time in restaurants,
too.
And
this is actually, we've talked about this on a different different episode about how some people don't tip on wine, like on bills at restaurants, mm-hmm. which to me is insane.
It's gross.
Like, it's gross and it's insane. And like, I had no idea that was a thing because Adam, like on that episode of the podcast, like Adam brought it up and I was like, what? People don't tip on wine?
People don't tip on wine.
But I'm like, and this goes into something else I know that you could talk about, like that you're not just not tipping your server now, I know, is like, you're also not even like giving support to the people of color that probably made that wine happen.
Right.
It's like, it's
all still connected. I think the issue is that we treat, because of the class ties wine has, right?
Yeah, because wine is classist as fuck.
Right. Like, regardless of even if you're talking about natural wine, you're like, these poor farmers. Like, you know, like, it is still really tied up in class, wine is. And so what people forget is that when people look at a bottle of wine, it's easy for them to dismiss the bodies that got to it. And it's really always interesting to me, specifically, you know, I'm going to say this, when the natural wine world spends so much time talking about the farmers, the wine producers, but do not talk about the laborers that make that possible. And so when people go to a store and buy a bottle of wine, different than when they buy an avocado, they don't think about the bodies that made it possible to get that. And honestly, I think it's because we as wine people, I'll include mine, that have been really poor of telling people the full story.
Well, and I think that it's taking a lot of time to get people to think also about wine as an agricultural product.
Yeah.
Like, I think that there's a huge disconnect between, and this is a big thing that I wrote about in my book, and like I talk about it a lot, is that, like, you know, you've got, if you care about your kale, you got to care about your wine. Like, how is it that I, like, you know, I go to the farmer's market down the street from my house and like bougie ass Silver Lake, and people are like dithering over which microgreens, and then they go and buy Korbel. Like, I see them go and buy, and I'm like, it's a part of the same process.
And also, you know, we have to have a conversation about like the privilege of getting to care about your kale and the privilege of being able to care about
Absolutely.
Your wine.
Well, going sort of back a little, a thought that I've never had before, which is, you know, the point of all of this, the every single delivery person that delivers wine to our restaurant, who touches all of those boxes and delivers them and probably load them into the truck and drove the truck around the city, every single one of them is black or brown. I do not have a white delivery driver at my restaurant. And that person is completely erased from the conversation.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, not even acknowledged.
Right. Acknowledged.
They work for Zephyr and they deliver to every single restaurant that you has a Michelin star or whatever has to get their shit delivered. And who's delivering it? And how are they being paid? What are their wages? What are their fucking health care? What is all that? And so we ignore everything in between there. The shipping,
everything.
Fuck. Blowing my mind.
Like, we just ignore every part of it. And it's part of the problem. Like, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking about this. And I'm even thinking about times that I haven't paid attention. But, like, how do you treat your delivery person that delivers your wine? Do you know their name? Have you learned their name? You wouldn't find it acceptable in a restaurant to not know the name of your dishwasher. So why is the person who drops off your water? Because it's a route. It's not like,
and also,
they're there.
It's a route. It's not like the person's changing every time.
Yeah,
like,
no, it's true.
It's generally like the same couple of people. And so, to me, again,
you know your reps' names.
You know your reps' names.
Let me just say this: I know my UPS guy. His name is Sergio. I have his phone number. Shouts to Sergio because me and him are homies. And like,
that's also because you have a fortress.
Well, no, but also too, I get wine delivered, and like, and so, but do you know how great it is to have a relationship with Sergio, my guy? Like, it's like, yes, have that relationship with someone that's on your route every day. Like, have, like, make, you know.
But the difference is,
well, there is a huge difference.
But I think what I'm saying,
I was making it a little light.
Yeah,
sorry.
But no. But I think that I guess what I want to point to by saying this for the people who are like, well, you know, what does that have to do with anything? Is that a lot of times we forget that the way that we reinforce stories in our lived actions. And one of the ways that we make spaces exclusionary, that touch with your delivery driver is another reinforcement that the wine world isn't inclusive. Because, like, let me tell you something. Cocktail bars, I thought it was the weirdest thing when I started working at bars. They talk to all the delivery people. They're like, yo, when your birthday, come in, have a drink. Like, you know,
that is not a thing I see in wine.
Right, you know what I'm saying? And it was like the weirdest thing to me. Like, not all bars do it, but a lot of them do. Like the
I always offer water. That's about, but that's like, I feel like that was the extent of what the wine world could do.
And it was like, it's always been like really interesting to me when I moved over to that sector where I would see these conversations where, you know, one of the bars I worked at, every delivery driver, we were like, come in for your drink for your birthday. Like, please bring your wife.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's people who I now have relationships with and who are now cocktail people because that was their entrance into that world and that was their thing. And how are we losing, like, people who could spread the gospel of wine by just not even being intentional about the people we interact with?
I would have seen those people go home and they go, fuck those people.
Exactly.
That's what I would assume.
They assume. I'm pretty sure that they do.
I mean, yeah. And also, too, like, I mean.
Because I would.
Right. Right.
Well, and what's interesting, like something that I know that I, you know, I've been thinking about. I mean, this Times piece has opened so many.
Oh yeah, let's talk. About that.
Well, no. But it goes into. But it goes back to what you're talking about, though, is that what this piece kind of taught. One of the things that working on this piece taught me is that, you know, we have been so quick to draw community lines around styles of wine.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, liking a style of wine does not actually make you a good person. And it does not, and it's made me, it, like, this thing has made me really reevaluate how I choose what community is, and like saying like, okay, because there were people in the conventional wine world that I never in a billion fucking years would have thought. Like, I never would have thought that they would be such an important part of this of the Times piece, and they were from two different worlds, and they were so so instrumental in helping me get information and get that to the Times, and they talked to the Times, and their support was like unwavering, and these are people that I wouldn't necessarily have ever, and so my thing is like, all right, that delivery man that you might be ignoring that you could invite in for a glass of wine, and maybe he can't do it on the job or whatever, but maybe that person you don't know could be someone so valuable in your community that you could bring into
and
your
it's not
community.
A, could and, be. They are someone.
Yeah, well,
valuable.
They already are. They already are. And let's actually bring them in. Like, even Sergio, my UPS guy, when he does me a solid, I leave him bottles of wine.
And
he loves wine now. He was like, I don't know about wine. I don't know. And I was like, Sergio, I've left you a six pack because he did me a super solid one day, like of like getting like trans.
Yeah,
the whole thing.
I mean, you got to treat your delivery people good.
Hey,
I
treat all your people right, please. Like, I don't have, you know what? I don't have a ton of money. I do everything I can to make sure that I give whatever I can.
You don't need to have
a
ton of money to treat
people
good.
Exactly. And so I left him this six pack of wine, and like not shitty wine. Like, I left him like wine, you know. And he looked like, next time I saw him, he was like, thank you so much. Like, I love wine now. Like, those are the best, you know?
Yeah, he's like, you got that Susukaro?
Yeah.
He's like, so. No, I mean, I think that I think that what you're pointing out is really important. And one of the things that, like, the wine world, and this happens also in the cocktail world too, is like craft bartenders shit on like people who don't work in craft bars or people who work in like nightclubs. And it's you know, it's shitty because you guess what? We're an ecosystem. Like, I tell people all the time, like, you need all parts of this industry for this to work, yeah. Right? You don't have value as a natural wine bar unless there's that shitty wine bar who's getting all of those people.
100%.
Do you get what I'm saying? There's also 100%. Not, also like with wine, it always interests me because it's like you have a limited number. It's not like distilling. It's not like alcohol, right? So you are limited by the land. You are limited, yes, literally about how much you can create. We do nothing by shaming people. And I need to say this because you talking about how looking at wine as an agricultural product, we need to talk about the moralizing of food and the and how much of America we have done. We've done a disgusting thing where we've made food a moral standing.
Yeah.
And wine attach, like, it's specifically in the conversation about natural wine versus conventional wine, it's much of the same type of language.
Well, and that's like, it's interesting because you know, I write about natural wine, but like the way that I got into wine was I was drinking $2-3 like super commercial super shit wine. And so like even today when I was on a call earlier today with this Northwestern professor and law professor, and she was like, oh well, I'm so embarrassed to admit that I still drink Two-Buck Chuck. And I was like, you don't need to be embarrassed. I was like, everyone starts somewhere, and like everyone can, like, there's no shame in where you are in your, like,
we don't have an equitable food system, like, before we even get to wine. So we have no business shaming anybody about their food practices.
Yeah, let's just worry about people eating.
That's the first thing.
It brings me out to this song by Kemba, this hip-hop artist, Last Year Being Broke, which is a song that I love. And he says, you've got your fruit organic, we've got different problems.
Right.
Because he's talking about, like, oh, you know what, you're so fucking concerned with your fucking organics, and like, I'm out here, I just need money for my fucking family, and like, I'm living on someone's couch right now.
Well, again, and this goes back to, you are so concerned and have the privilege and the space to care about natural wine,
yeah,
when there's some fucking kid who just wants to, who looks inside your restaurant, looks inside your bar, and is just trying to figure out how they get to be inside of
totally
them.
Yeah.
No,
I was I was going to go back just a little bit farther. Yeah. I've worked with a lot of bartenders, and always the best bartenders I've ever worked with are the ones that started at like the gunslinging, like,
oh, they're always the best. Oh my god.
The people who like worked at like the just like the turn and burn.
Oh my god.
And then they go into craft. They're always the best bartenders. The people who just started in craft are always like so.
The people I hired from Cheesecake Factory.
Yeah, exactly.
Or TGI Friday.
Exactly.
Always
exactly.
My fucking
best. Yeah, yeah, always.
You worked at TGI Friday. You worked at you got a job.
Yeah, yeah, no. Always.
You made it
always.
Work.
Like, you, I definitely.
My favorite
hire
server
you.
That's working right now got is there's a place called Beaner's, Barney's Beanery.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Which is a problematic place in and of itself in its history, but it's like a turn and burn college bar, just like fucking people get trash faced. Oh, he's such a good server. He's so good.
Because once you go from there, like, and people also don't know this about me, I got my start in like sports bars, and I worked at Harry Carey's.
Oh my god!
Wait, like from Chicago, the guy who
I worked at Harry Carey's Navy Pier
because she's from Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm from Chicago originally. I worked at Harry Carey's Navy Pier. Yeah, and like people would make fun of me. Like I still would be like trying to work my like cool job, but I would work at Harry's Pier, and people like, why do you work there? Let me tell you something. When you deal with tourists, when you deal with having to have an 8-table section with kids and other stuff,
yeah,
and you have to sell like. Selling wine to some snooty motherfucker ain't shit.
Yeah.
I worked at Buca de Beppo.
Absolutely.
Like, ain't
absolutely.
Nothing. Like,
I worked at Buca de Beppo, and I got to say, it gives you mad, like, people skills and, like being able to, like, just handle
people,
everything.
And that's the thing that we just, like, everybody just has to realize. I want to bring it back to your thing about sustainability and community.
Well,
we can bow tie it.
Yeah.
And move on, but... Here's
what I have a question. I want you to do that, but it might not be the. I might undo the bow tie. Just
oh, well, just ask the question.
Well, I guess like because so to go back, I guess to like the original like, and I love this dialogue that we're having so much. How, I guess, how do we work on having people engage in these difficult conversations? Because, and what I've done is that the people that I felt that were not supporting me, that I've supported greatly, and that I was really, and this is a personal thing, and you know, like I realize that, but as a survivor myself, it hurt me, you know, because it's like, wow, because I do think of, like, I've always thought about natural wine and, like, you know, it is an ecosystem. And I always thought of myself as a part of that ecosystem. And recently, only over the past year, I realized I'm actually not or not in a lot of people, you know. And so the way that I, you know, I talked to the people that I was like, hey, like, you know, what's the deal? Like, why is it that this didn't matter to you? Like, why is it that this, you didn't reach out to me? You didn't, like, for all you knew, I was the one that was assaulted.
And what was their answer?
They said that they don't know how to deal with these things.
Yes.
And so it's like, I know that it's important to have these conversations, but I guess my question to you is, or I guess the thing I'm saying is, like, sustainability in terms of, like, sexual assault is, like, so prevalent in the entire world, not
about
single,
saying,
yeah,
saying,
yeah, like, everywhere. So this does not just, like, revolve.
We don't value women, so
yeah,
you know,
we know.
Yeah,
I'm like, Adam's like, I don't value you either.
No, yeah, kidding.
But so it's like,
you know, I have my own problem. I definitely have my own problems. No, I do. I like it's...
Okay, Columbia. Like,
No.
But
I'm learning every day.
Of course. And to finish, I guess.
I mean, with respecting women, I have a problem with it myself. Like, I feel like I'm an advocate or whatever, and I know every day I do something that is totally fucking wrong.
So my thing is that, okay, I'm talking to these people. I'm letting them know personally that, hey, I need your support. But I guess my question to you is, for people that don't know how to support survivors or don't know how to, you know, to be a part of this conversation, maybe it makes them uncomfortable or they've never dealt with this. You know, they've never known someone maybe that's been assaulted or anything. How do we?
They definitely know somebody who's been assaulted. They may not know that they've been assaulted.
So
definitely
how
know
do I guess my thing is, let's say the people, you know, I have a large Instagram following that, you know, there's a lot of people that I'm not close enough with to have these personal conversations with. How do we get people to engage?
Impact over intention.
Okay.
You know, we're doing a lot of the work that we are. Here's one thing I want to say to everybody who's listening. It is not as high stakes as you think. One of the reasons why we struggle as human beings to get anything fucking done or to do anything is because we build up in our head that, and we build this logical fallacy. Logical fallacies are mental processing that we fall into, right? Where we shut our brains down and we say, I either can do this or that. When you do that to your brain and you only give it an either or option, you set down the possibilities of your mind. That's the first thing. The second thing is then you escalate everything, right? Because this decision, if I do this decision or if I make a mistake, feeling as if you make a mistake makes you a bad person is a product of white supremacy, right? Because it's stating that there is either a moral good and a moral bad. And the fact of the matter is that we're much more in the gray than we want to talk about. We are all a work in progress. So it is not that high stakes. If you want to know how to support survivors, ask them. The best thing that we can do in all practices of our life is communicate from a consent-based standpoint. The first thing that a survivor needs when they have had something taken away from them is the ability to choose how they move. So when you ask this survivor, I would like to say, I'm not sure what you need. I'm not even sure how to respond, but you have my support. And if there's something I could do, please let me know. You will empower them to make the decision of how they want to interact with you and how they need you. Now, let me tell you what more often happens. Is that people say, I want to support survivors, and they create things, they create panels, they create conversations, they do an Instagram post without ever asking the survivor if that's what support looks like for them. Support isn't a universal thing. It is subjective, just like respect.
And so, and I agree, and I, as a survivor myself, I agree, and I think it's interesting because it changes every day. Like, some days I do want to talk about what's happened to me, other days I don't, and like, you know, and but I guess also too,
it has to be a living conversation.
Yes, and then, but, and I guess the follow-up question to that is, like, how do we like within a community on a larger scale, how do we spread awareness of these things? You know, and it's like, you know, I don't know if you have the answers for this.
I get it. I get asked that a lot. I think like we've got to stop making it seem like any type of abuse, whether it's sexual assault, whether it's financial abuse, whether
domestic abuse,
whether it's domestic violence, which is our, you know, let's be honest, that's the hospitality's little dark secret that no one wants to talk about, is how many men up here are saying they love women and then going home and beating the shit out of their partner.
Yeah.
You know, like it's Adam's like, oh my god. I'm sorry.
No, what I want to say is like I'm listening and I'm and the thing that I don't know if this is the right thing or this is the appropriate thing or whatever, but like the thing I'm taking from a lot of this is why would I be putting the onus on, let's say, you to tell me mm-hmm. how to be a better person when it should be me who should be asking myself how to be a better person?
We talk about community and we think of community as this thing that's an abstract theory rather than something that is a living conversation that we are always in. It's about your relationship to and with. We're talking about. It's about your relationship to and with. And so when I say impact over intention, a lot of times intentions are created from our desires and needs. So often when we see someone in pain or hurt or whatever, we say, I want to, I wish, I want to support, but what's the impact you're trying to create? Yeah. Because if you want to impact that person, you have to ask yourself, what is impactful for them? Which may not be aligned with what your desires and wants are.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that is the place you have to work from in saying, and you have to ask yourself, what is the thing? You know what? When I talk to a survivor, I want them to feel safer.
Absolutely.
Can I make them feel safe? No. But I want them to know when they are within my company and when I am in their presence, they are safer. They have someone there standing with them, which means I can't base the way I interact off of them based on what I want to do. I have to ask them, what would make you feel safer in this moment?
Well, even like with...
I'm going to cry.
Well, and like...
No, it's serious. Like,
he does cry. He's a cry.
Yeah, it's not even that. Like,
he's like, I don't cry.
I'm crying because like...
Well,
it's hard to think that you are hurting people and that your actions hurt people mm-hmm. and what you do hurts people.
Mm-hmm.
And I can think a lot of times when I've probably hurt people and I thought my best intentions were not to hurt people.
But
and
the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Exactly. And that is,
But here's the thing about when we do harm. We can rectify.
Yeah.
Yes.
And this is what everybody forgets. It's like,
yeah,
anybody who has done harm, anybody who's like, I was supposed to have a conversation and I did it really poorly, or I should have did better, or I dropped that ball. You know that conversation that you were like, oh, I was supposed to have this conversation with them and I never addressed it and now it's too late. It's not.
Yeah. I mean, look at
you
us.
You can
look at us.
Yeah.
We're talking to each other.
We're going
to
get to it in a minute.
You can literally choose right now to send a message and say, hey, something happened and I didn't know how to process it. I didn't know how to speak to you about it. And so I said nothing. And I'm not sure how you felt about that, but it still sits with me and doesn't feel good. So if you want to have a conversation, I wanted to make it open so that that's a possibility.
And I think you reposted something on your Instagram, I think like 2 weeks ago, that I almost reposted today. I'm not kidding when I say that Ashton's Instagram is like one of the most incredible educational tools for the work that we all need to be doing. And you reposted this thing that just said, your apology needs to be as loud as your harm.
Oh, keep the same energy.
And that to me spoke volumes, because there are people that are doing harm and there are massive amounts of harm, and their apologies are whispers.
I want to explain to people what transformative justice is, because I don't think a lot of people know what it is.
Yeah.
So transformative justice is a conversation about community healing. And it's basically when you take the person who has done harm and the person who has been harmed, and you center the person who has been harmed, but you have a conversation about how that harm can be rectified and how both people can get support. Let me tell you something. There is a type of grief, and I've been working on this a lot, and I've been thinking about this a lot, but so I'm finally just going to say this publicly because I've been working on it. For people who have done harm, there is a grief that happens for them. And that grief is surrounded by the misalignment of who they think they are and how they've behaved have not aligned. And so a lot of people will lean into their ego.
I was going to say, it's such an ego thing.
Because they are scared, right? Because their bluff is being called that you said you were this person, but we are complex people. And so if you open up to say there are possibilities for this action to be true and for me still be a good person, there is a point in the middle where we can rectify. The issue is that you have to grieve that the person you were before you did that harm is not the person you are right now.
Yeah.
And the reason why I say you have to grieve that is because that is a loss, and that is a loss of a self.
Yeah.
But with that loss comes awareness of how you can be better.
Which I think...
Yeah, I'm moved. I'm sorry. That is.
Yeah, Adam's.
Forgiveness to yourself is so hard.
And that is where we have to start, right?
Yeah.
We
have absolutely.
We have to start with.
He's actually now dying.
Yeah, no, that was just a little. But like, all I can think is just like, yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And also, it's part of. Someone else forgiving you, yes, can give you permission to forgive yourself. But the hardest part is forgiving yourself.
Yeah, if you can't love yourself, how the fuck can you love someone else?
Right. But I think that also, too, that comes with also the harmer acknowledging the harm that they caused.
And
sitting with that harm. And
this is why they need support, right?
Yeah.
Because when we isolate people in their grief, let's say something, you can grieve the loss of a person, right? What we know is that we make people, and we are very poor at surrounding people, right? When they are grieving. And so when you leave somebody who's done harm, and I tell people all the time, we make playgrounds for abusers because of our unwillingness to accept that they are a product of our communities.
Yeah.
Like, that is why this continues, because we excommunicate them to go do damage in someone else's community rather than rectifying that at some point that person was harmed. At some point, this behavior was learned. Abuse is practice.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And also, too, though, I think, though, and like just to like for because I think that I think it could be construed with what you're saying, like this, the abuser grieving and stuff that doesn't exclude them from consequences.
Oh, hell no.
You know, and that's, I think, like, you know what I mean? It's like.
Wait,
it's like,
you're saying that, oh, shit.
Well, you know, it's like, this is what I'm, you know, but what I mean is like.
No, you can go to jail and you can go to jail for the rest of your life and you can also.
But this is what I'm saying, like, your apology.
Forgiveness.
Your apology needs to be as loud as the harm that you created. And like, you need to acknowledge that harm and like, you can grieve that
person.
That's
a part of accountability.
Yeah. And like, I think that's like the part of this.
Transformative justice is about accountability. It's about healing and it's about accountability.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe that's like the second part.
Yeah, that's the second part. Yeah.
So I was like, I don't want people thinking that we just need to be
No. I mean, I think like you need to let them cry. And then you also need to say these are your consequences. I think like, you know, I think that we forget that boundaries are the extension. Adrienne Marie Brown says this. Boundaries are the extension in which we can love people.
Yeah.
Right? So when I call somebody in to say you've done harm, first of all, depending on the harm, it doesn't need to be high stakes. Right? We, even in our everyday relationships, sometimes do harm.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It's about when you call somebody in, you are saying, I am doing the labor of telling you how the way you treated me is not how I want to be in community with you. You're reestablishing boundaries and you're telling them how they can be better to make sure that you never have to end up here again.
But I think it's just really important to also say that the consequences, though, are important.
Like, yeah, I'm not. Like, I'm not saying that consequences are important.
No, I know you're not. But I just think that right now with what's happened, like, I think right now with the time season in particular, there's some people that don't believe that there should be consequences for their actions.
I think you can't focus on that.
Of course.
Here's what I'm going to tell you. There are always going to be people who are going to believe that they should be able to circumvent accountability. And what we can't do is we don't have, our energy is not infinite.
No, it's not.
Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I've been real tired lately.
People who don't want to be in community with us, they've made their choice, right? But we have to leave room for people. And what I think, and what my point is, I think there's a much higher number of people who want to be in community with us, and we have not given them a way of how they can do it.
Yeah.
We're talking about the whole world.
The whole world.
We're talking about the whole world.
Yeah, whole world. And I think even in the wine world. And what I'm saying to you, and the reason why I'm saying this, and I'm hoping that this frees somebody, because there is someone out there who has sexually harassed somebody and didn't know it was sexual harassment.
Absolutely.
There is someone out there who has assaulted someone and didn't know that they assaulted them. Yep. Do you get what I'm saying?
I was actually going to bring up I think the Aziz Ansari debacle, or whatever you want to call
that
it.
That journalist is trash, but yeah.
But that whole thing, I think the reason why it was, other than the fact that he was a celebrity, but like, I think the whole thing was it laid in that area where I know, because I talked to other men and they're like, that's not sexual assault. And I was like, you're only saying that because you've done that.
Exactly. And so we have to leave room for those people to be able to rectify and be able to still be good people, but rectify their harm.
Yeah.
Yes. Which I think now, talking about not good people or whatever, but so an interesting thing about Ashton and Adam being here in the same room is that
I wanted this to happen more naturally, but you can do
No, it's fine. Well, no, because I think that we could all because I'm like, I know that we're on time.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really, so Ashton called out Adam on some,
I don't know if call out is the right term. I think she pointed stuff out, because call out, I don't know, maybe that terminal, I don't like that, but I don't know.
Well, I'll say this. Ashton
enlightened me.
Yes. Well, she made a comment on a post of yours.
Yeah.
I can't remember the comment.
I can't either.
Oh,
unfortunately.
I'm surprised. I'm surprised it's not like burned into Adam's fucking
No. It was something along the lines of I don't remember what you said, but I responded back, and my response was classic.
You were reactionary.
I was classic privileged white person response, like canned, like I'm an activist. I support people.
Don't you know I co-host a show with Marissa Ross?
Yeah, I have five black friends.
Yeah,
like it was. It was super bad. Like, yeah.
But and what's interesting, and you know, like Adam called me right when it was happening, and I was like, "Yo, you need to like relax and just calm. Like the thing you need to do, you already fucked up because you didn't just listen. Like fucking like listeners out there." You're doing a great job listening right now. Remember to listen to people when they fucking tell you that, like, when they're saying something to you. But what's great to me is that Ashton came over yesterday and we brought it up, and she was like, "I don't think Adam's a bad person, you know." And like, and this is what you're talking about now. It's like, you know, having mistakes, you know, is okay. And like, now the two of you are
think
all
about
together.
How much stronger and more powerful I'm going to be.
Well, no, because you
when I
a
have
lot.
Ashton with me, and we're going, and we're going to fucking crush everything. You know what I mean? We're like,
okay, white man, don't be taking her.
You know what I'm saying? But like, as I grow and as I learn, and it's not your job to teach me.
No, it's not, and you're right. But what I think people forget is like there are things, and my therapist says this. There are things called ruptures, right, where we like. We say a truth that's deep and it ruptures the relationship, right?
Yeah,
and often ruptures
the relationship you have with yourself.
Oh yeah,
going back to what you were saying.
Yeah,
about
it ruptures the relationship, and so people get really defensive and upset because there's like you're
Adam.
Making a statement about me.
Yeah, that's hard. It's hard to come to terms with the fact that I said things that could be conceived as racist. That's not a fucking thing I want to hear.
Yeah.
That's also not something that I want to hear about myself, which is probably true. I'm a white man. Of course there's shit that I do that's racist. There
right.
can't not be.
Right.
It's the way the system's built.
And look, I made that comment after getting it sent to me, honestly, in my DM by about 12 different people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think what we forget is that, especially on social media, what people forget, and look, I've had to deal with this. There's people who are like, I don't like the, you know, I get stuff all the time, is that we forget that not everybody knows us personally. So when you write something for your people and you're like, oh, well, people know me, like maybe they don't, right?
No, the thing is that what I've learned is that they absolutely don't.
They absolutely don't. And so you just have to be intentional about what you're putting out there and how you're putting it out there. And I, in my mind, I could hold this man is probably not a racist, meaning like you not out here Ku Klux Klan in it. You know what I mean? Like this man
you
is.
You don't know him that
well. Wow. Okay. Yeah, wow. Wait a minute.
That's not a good joke. I'm sorry, Adam. I'm like, I'm like, you know,
this is like 13.7% alcohol. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's 40% alcohol.
I could hold that, and yeah. also hold that, like, this post he just made was really alienating for a lot of Black people.
Yeah,
and it made them really uncomfortable.
And I was naive enough before that to not understand that, and I am now less naive to understand how and why.
Yeah.
And that is something where I now remember the post. The post was, I took the word gangsta and I abbreviated it into, like, because there's a lot of white psalms that use hip hop terminology. Mm-hmm. And that was me commenting on those idiots. But at the same time, me commenting on those idiots is me being one of those idiots.
Well, and I don't think it was that you were commenting on anything. I think it was the lack of context that you were making a satire about them.
Yeah, that,
and the issue.
Yeah.
And for people who didn't know you, it looked like a reinforcement.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And what I'll say about the wine world, and the natural wine world specifically, that eventually, this is a whole nother podcast we're going to have a conversation about, is that people use Black people like we're fucking props. They use our culture like it's a fucking prop. And at a certain point, it gets old.
Yeah, fuck Action Bronson.
Like, you're like, this is our life. And you are playing with it like it's just a tool for promotion.
No.
I don't have a problem with people liking hip-hop. I don't have a problem with people liking Black culture. What I have a problem with is that we get shamed and we can't get access because of the way we talk or the way we dress or this or that or where you think we came from. We can't get the job you get, but you get to be a job and listen to hip-hop and sell the shit that we want to do, and it's not even fucking yours.
Yeah.
Well, and you made an interesting point yesterday when we were talking about this, because before I invited Ashton to be on the podcast, I was like, oh, I better, you know, make
you sure. were expecting to be so much more Jerry Springer.
No. I actually wasn't. Only because I've spoken with Ashton a lot, and, you know, we have mutual friends. Yeah. And I knew that
people always are like so afraid of me, and I'm like, I'm really
it's because you're direct, and it's because on the internet everyone reads things in the worst way possible. Think about emails you get from like your boss or like whoever it is. I'm always
people are always so scared of me. I'm like, yo, I'm really chill. If you piss me off, like, I'm gonna give you the business. But
something you said that was really interesting about like Adam's memes was like that I hadn't even thought about was like you were like, you know, he's making these jokes that are super insidery that if like these younger people of color, they're trying to get into this world.
And no, yeah, absolutely.
And they haven't gotten to that level yet to understand that joke. And like that, while that joke might've worked when it was just, you know, like 600
when
people,
I was yeah, 6,000 followers or whatever. And
well,
it was
no,
just
and,
my
and,
small circle.
And what I told Ashton is like, yeah, like no one knows, like talking about like how no one knows you on the internet. No one, like, unless you listen to the podcast, no one knows that you were the beverage director and like the GM at some of the most important restaurants in Los Angeles, to where that's why you're making those jokes. And then to those people that are just trying to break in.
And yeah, it just feels like another thing that's like, oh, this isn't for me.
Yeah,
and
no, I don't know.
And I don't get the joke.
You probably haven't noticed, but since that interaction,
I've noticed.
I've changed my interaction on the internet, and I've changed my posts, and I've changed who I represent myself, because I realized I was not having open arms.
And I like the memes. Like, well, I like the memes.
You made a good point when you said they just need context.
They just need context. Yeah. I'm not mad at the memes, but I think
I'm trying to make an effort to be
and I think
more conscious of
this
stuff.
This is what people I want everybody to get. There's nothing wrong with your memes. There's nothing wrong with poking fun. But when you know that you're a part of a select group, and being a part of the wine world, even if it's just the conventional wine world, is a privilege. It is a severe privilege. And so when you make these jokes or things, or you make these kind of insider things, remember, because I was this girl, there's some poor or brown or woman or all three looking and trying to figure out how to get in there, and you haven't left any door cracked.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't want to be that person.
I don't want to be that person.
Like,
you haven't left the door cracked. And so we've got to be really, and even I have to sometimes, like, we have to be really, really clear when we do these things, like, who are we doing them for? Who are they? And provide context.
And I think that also can change, too, from, like, I mean, like, depending on your audience, you know, like, I mean, I think that there's a, you know, when I'm at a natural wine conference, and I'm speaking on a panel.
Right.
And it's like, then I can be, and I'm like shitting all over like how commercial wine is made, whatever. Or like, even like, I think that most people that listen to our podcast are already, you know, like are beyond this thing. But like it's so important to like, even going back to what we were talking about earlier, like I started drinking, I got into wine because of Charles Shaw, and like, there is no reason to shame
anyone. We need Charles Shaw.
Yeah.
We need Charles Shaw.
Yeah. Like,
we need Yellowtail. Let me tell you something. You want to know why Louis Vuitton and Gucci and all of them haven't shut down people making fucking ripoff of their bags? Because the fake makes the real thing more valuable.
Yeah.
So let me tell you something. In terms of the wine business, you need your Yellowtails. You need your Charles Shaw. Why? Because that only makes the real shit that much more valuable. If you didn't have something to compare it to, none of that shit would have
value.
But
we also can still say that we wish that they were made better. More ethical.
Yeah, we can totally say that. I mean, I think we can say we can hold both.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. We can hold both.
It's
not
the gray. It's the gray.
It's the gray. And people think that everything is like mutually exclusive.
Yeah,
like,
no,
it's,
you can't. You know, it's not.
It's just not.
That's like, that logical fallacy of a binary.
Yeah, and
it's either or.
And it's sort of like I obviously follow Ashton and her work very like very closely, and it's like people get. Real like they do think you're an aggressive, like that you're going to be an aggressive person or whatever, and it's like, actually no, you're just honest and direct, and like you're holding people accountable without demonizing them. And I think that people need to realize that being
accountability
doesn't
always have to be punitive.
Yeah. And
conflict is not abuse.
And I think that that's.
And if my feelings are hurt because a black woman says I said something wrong, maybe I should look at myself
that's
as opposed
why
to.
I said it when he called me. When he called me, I was like, yo, why didn't you? You should have just listened.
Yeah, but, no, it's true. Like, I mean, it's one of those things.
It's hard.
It's hard.
I had an indigenous woman call me out a year and a half ago. I think people think I don't get called out. And.
No, you are too vocal not to get called out. Even if the call outs aren't warranted, I just
yeah.
No,
I about
no
to
way.
Say I get, but like I had an indigenous woman call out, and it ended up being a really interesting conversation because, it was around me calling myself a content pioneer, and she was like, "Pioneer is such a fucking colonized like word, like it's related to so much trauma and blah blah."
Yeah.
And she said this, and I just wrote, "Thank you, okay." And she went into this rant where she was like, "You're gaslighting me. You're da 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 da." And I was like, "Wait, whoa, what's happening?" And
she's like, "This is the problem with the internet."
And she was like, "I was like, what's happening? Like, I'm literally saying thank you, okay. Like, I'm gonna go think about this and take this off." I said, "But what I do know is I'm gonna take this immediately out of my caption because even if it just makes you uncomfortable, it's not worth it."
Yeah. This is the problem with social media though, is because like I said, people generally read things in the worst way possible. So I bet you she was like, she read it as
it
like,
says, like
thank
sarcastic.
You. Okay.
Yeah,
you
she know? Read it as sarcastic, and I was really just like
I'm telling you, my husband almost every day has to be like, Marissa, don't read, like I'll read him an email and I'll be, this fucking bitch, can you fucking believe this bitch wrote me this fucking email? Da 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 da, and he's like. Listen.
Tomato sandwich? How dare she?
And he's like, listen to your own inflection that you are projecting onto this email.
Well, the stories we tell ourselves.
With the stories and that has to do with our own history, our own trauma,
our own things. So we have to really uncenter ourselves when we have discussions.
Which is
like
even
that.
What you were talking about with our community.
Yeah, like we have to uncenter ourselves. And so look, I've been called out before. It doesn't feel good. Your heart starts racing.
Yeah. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You start going into this thing. And like the thing that I tell people is like immediacy is a byproduct of capitalism. And so we force our minds to come to immediate conclusions because we've been told we don't have enough time. When someone calls you out, you don't need to respond right away. You can take a deep breath.
Well, and that's, I think, the...
You can take a deep breath and say, this is not a conversation about your morality or who you are as a person, even if this person thinks it is.
Yeah.
You can stop and say that to yourself. You can take a deep breath. You can call a friend and say, I need some support. I'm getting called out, and I want to respond graciously and openly because I would like this to be a learning opportunity.
Yeah.
I am interested in the possibilities of knowing and learning my own growth edge.
And I think this also goes into like this.
Yeah.
Is a big,
man, this is my favorite podcast we've had so far. Yeah.
Well, but and it goes
just for my own personal.
No, me too. And something that was a
we don't even have to put this on the internet. I just, am really enjoying.
No,
this.
No, yeah, and this year for me, me, white woman. there's a white woman in the room. Excuse me. No.
All right, Alice. But,
okay,
we're gonna.
But that would. I mean,
we're not cutting it.
I'm about to say, where's the lie, though?
Where is the lie? There ain't one. But what I was going to say is that this year for me has been really learning about how not to be reactionary, which I also think that social media and like the immediacy of internet teaches us like, oh, we have to respond right now. And also like the 24-hour news cycle, like there's all these things that are influencing us to be extremely reactionary to that, the sense that like, oh, I see something or someone says something to me or whatever, I have to respond right now. And I'm so, and your emotions are so high and it is so easy to just do.
And we always
got to take a step back though.
And you have to, because our body responds fight
or
freeze.
Yeah. Which everyone forgets about freeze.
Everybody forgets about freeze.
I thought it was important. Fuck.
No.
Yeah. Is that wrong?
Well, yeah, because I was just about to say like everyone forgets about freeze when it comes to sexual assault.
Yeah, and everybody gets about freeze when it comes to abuse, period. Most people freeze. Most people freeze when anything is kind of presented to them that they are
not. But not on the internet.
On the internet, they're like
fight.
Well, people get Twitter fingers. They're like, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, anybody who knows me, because I'll be honest, I can't be a scary person. But, you know, I am from the South Side of Chicago. So like,
which is like,
I have to constantly like let people know, as someone who's raised in Memphis, Tennessee, and Chicago, like also though, keep the same energy. Don't talk to me crazy on the internet, and then when I see you in person,
oh yeah, no.
But
oh yeah,
like
be who
like,
you are.
Be who you like. You better make sure the person you're representing talking to me all gully is the same.
Well,
person
you better
that
be walking
to,
that like you better be walking that talk. Because my thing is like, I will say like people be like, oh, you're talking shit about someone. I'm like, nope. Because if they were right here, I'd tell them the exact same thing. Shit. I don't give a fuck.
And also like, we got to get out of this stuff of like talking shit. Like a truth is a truth. Like, you know, if you like somebody and you hear a bad thing about them and you're now upset because that bad thing doesn't and go with your viewpoint of them, like you're dismissing actual real factual information just because it doesn't fit the narrative in the story you want to tell your mind.
Hitler was really nice to dogs.
Hitler
and
was
children.
Actually,
I mean, he took
actually,
a bunch of children.
I mean, the conversation I tell people all the time is like, Hitler was actually really nice to a lot of people to their face. He had all his lieutenants do his dirty work.
Right. I mean, yeah, I know that Hitler, but yeah, of course.
Hitler. Well, you know, I mean, look, I mean, I think that the wine world, you know, so many of my followers are like always telling me about how I need to like comment more about the wine world.
I'm here for it. I support it. and even if it involves more, you know, me putting my fucking
foot in my mouth and learning, I
support it.
I think the reason why I haven't, and like, look, the reason why I haven't thus far is mostly because I'm not sure if it would create more possibilities for women of color like me, who I'm concerned, you know what I mean? Or if it would,
if their reaction would be like sea urchins.
Right. And so that's why I haven't in a while. But what I will say is that I love wine, always have. I went to my first vineyard when I was 12 years old and it changed my life.
What vineyard was it?
It was just a family vineyard. I had the great privilege of being chosen to be a people-to-people ambassador, and we had a homestay, and my homestay did what you're not supposed to do, which is they took me somewhere out of the city. They literally broke every rule on the homestay. And we went to their family vineyard, and I thought it was the most magnificent thing. And you know, my parents can tell you, like, I've always been enamored by wine. I lived in Paris and moved to France and lived there and had that privilege. And you know, it's always been something that's been a grounding and a center and kind of like a piece of my life.
Yeah, we don't want to take, wine is magical.
Well,
right?
Wine is magical. But
thing.
I think the, you know what? And I know that like, it's not only just like I think that that's a very legitimate fear. And like, you hadn't expressed that to me before. And I think that that's legitimate, you know, as we are moving forward, as we are doing our best, hopefully all of our best to uplift people of color and to like, try to not just educate them, but get them opportunities.
Yeah, like what's this fucking thing about? Also, I just got to say this. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Please stop acting like people of color, whether that and when you say people of color, please make sure you mean all people of color. You're not just talking about black people, because if you're talking about black people, then say black people. But please stop acting like people of color have no ways to get educated. Like that in itself is just ignorant as hell.
No,
there are inequities for sure. But the overextending assumption that black people have no ways to have access, it's fucking problematic.
Well, it's not addressing
the
real
assumption
problem.
That they are that they don't have access
the
to
assumption,
something.
The assumption that we're automatic, all of us are automatically ignorant.
Yeah.
All black people ain't poor.
Yeah.
All black people aren't uneducated. As a matter of fact, what y'all need to know is that black women are the most educated cohort
and
in this damn country.
I know, and they are probably the most powerful, like voting, like
and also most powerful. They think so, like really change the way. And like I'm sick of walking into your wine bars and you trying to tell me how your wine list isn't, oh, just so you know, it's not going to be set up this way, or asking me if I want Moscato, or asking me if I know that this Riesling is dry. If you don't do it to your white customers, don't fucking do it to me.
Well, and also too, you
told us that earlier, and I was like, I know that people do that. And I can't believe it.
But
that
going
people
to
fucking
what
do
you,
that.
But going to what you were saying, like move in terms of like moving forward as like a community, like we're bettering the wine industry. Like, don't assume that they don't have access to education. Let's focus on like in
ask people what they need. People will tell you what they need.
But people need opportunity. They need jobs. They need
employ them.
They employ them. Like don't like we need to work on that. And we need to like really focus on and so that's why I respect what you're saying, where you're like, oh, I don't know if I want to get into this wine.
I'm not saying that inequity isn't an issue.
But I understand your sentiment of being like, am I going to be a positive force for people of color in the wine world, which is already like a fucking gnarly cesspool, as we all know, in so many ways. But I think on like my side of things, you being more a part of the wine world is only going to be make things stronger for white people that already run this shit, and also create more opportunity. Because if we can get white people like Adam is a good dude.
I'm white. I don't know if people know that.
Yeah, we're all white. both of us white. You got Adam, who's already he's a good dude that already is supportive in a lot of ways. You got him to think about things in a way that he hadn't been before. Like, I think you being able to do that in the wine world and getting people to think about these things more, because we're not all bad people. We just don't know things. And
I don't
it's
a conversation,
but it's like opening the eyes of people to see another side of things that they've maybe never taken the time to see or
it's
don't
purely
know.
Access.
It's
right?
Purely it's purely access. I want to say right now, I'm not saying that there aren't inequity issues with access to education for one. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that the overwhelming assumption that people of color just don't have access is problematic in the wine world.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not that we can't get... Look at Cha, who created her own career. Look at Julie Connolly. Let me tell you, people who have had very little are very good at creating possibilities for themselves and figuring out how to get access. So they will tell you what they need. The issue is that people over and over aren't asking people who are marginalized what they need, and they're telling them what they want to give them.
It's just
that thing. So all I'm saying to them is that you really need to look at how your staff approaches people of color when they are at your bar. How do they treat them? You know, how are they speaking to them? How are they speaking to them? What are the biases and assumptions they're making in their service?
I'm going
to
ask another weird question.
Ask it.
So vintage white people from a little bit ago.
That is a real kind. That's real kind of you.
One of my good friends who's an equity worker, she calls white people who are she calls
boomers?
Them free, she calls them free range white people.
Free range vintage white people who have
like you also been too nice.
Who have this?
I'm thinking about these free range chickens. I'm like, these free range chickens aren't racist. We don't.
who say,
been free range.
Oh, I don't see color, right? That old
I call bullshit.
Right, that bullshit to 100 times degrees. Those are the people. So when I was growing up in the wine industry, those are the white people that I learned under. Those
boomers.
Basically, those, but also people, Xers.
Xers too. Those people who say that they don't see color, you are erasing your peers and people in your community's experience, because regardless of whether you fucking see it, we experience it every single day. And that conversation is about you and not about the people who have to navigate this world being a person of color.
Well, and this even goes back to the intersectionality thing.
Sorry, it's okay. So I was asking this. So as when a black person walks into a wine bar and it is all white, it's an all white establishment. Acknowledging, and I'm not saying like, oh, hey, you're black,
no.
but acknowledging the blackness or the person of color or something is not, I'm saying this to like white people out there, it's not a racist act to acknowledge color
or gender.
Right.
Like, I tell people all the time, do you talk to your mother the same way you talk to your girlfriend?
Yeah.
Nah.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you talk to them differently because they have different needs. What I'm saying is that the way that we're speaking to people of color, and specifically black people in wine, we're speaking to them as if they are other.
Right.
Well, and then also we are using them
and we're speaking to them as other. What I'm saying is that you can acknowledge that they are not your regular customer. You can acknowledge that they're different, and it doesn't have to be an othering that makes them feel as if they aren't welcome there. Right?
Right.
It can say, you can literally say, hey, is this your first time in?
Yeah.
And they can say, yeah. Or they could be like, no, I've been here 3 times. And be like, oh, okay, well, this is my first time meeting you. I'm such and such. Here goes your menu.
Yeah.
Right? And if it is the first time and you do have something that's different, rather than making, because this is also, you have to realize, we have to acknowledge the bravery of people who walk into spaces, whether it's conscious or unconscious, that they know aren't made for them.
No, they are potentially there's a 50-50 chance that it's an unsafe space where they can be harmed.
Right. And that's not just for people of color, that's for queer identified people.
And so even women.
I struggled like for this for a long time, because I would work
He's
with customers.
Again.
No, and I would acknowledge that they were a person of color. And then the whole time I would be serving them or interacting, I would remind myself to not treat them differently. And it was something that I would have to constantly remind myself, because I would find myself doing things like what you're talking about, like talking down or assuming things or having these preconceived notions. And so it's something that like I had to teach myself through this whole process, was like acknowledging their color is okay. And then just treat them like a fucking person.
Yeah.
And you don't have to sit there and worry about what am I doing? What am I not doing? How am I doing this? How am I doing that?
Exactly.
It took like, honestly, a lot of years for me to learn how to.
And this is a conversation of why, side tangent, and we don't need to get into it, but this is why it's a conversation about like our intimacy with communities that aren't like ours. And this is why gentrification is harmful. And this is why, you know, redlining is harmful, because it actually obstructs us from having daily interactions with the communities that look different than us. But like, I think what I would say to people is that one of the things that I've always loved, and I did love when I was selling wine on the floor, was the ability to give black people who walked in, or people of color, or queer people, a deep breath. They're like, you're not being weird. Because they can see it.
Yes, absolutely.
They can see it. They're like, oh, you're just being normal with me.
Yeah,
feels good.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
it's like, I see you.
I see you. And I'm not here to do this. I think what people get caught up in is that they're so worried about being called racist or not knowing what they need, when it's like, just ask people.
Yeah.
Just literally ask people. People will tell you what they need.
Well, don't ask them if you're racist. Ask them what
they need. I mean, no. Don't ask them.
Excuse me, am I racist?
No.
So I know I'm just showing up and giving you your message.
But am I racist? No, don't do that. But just ask them.
They're going to look at me and go, probably.
Like, why are you asking me that? You're definitely racist now.
But just like, definitely just ask them what they need. And I think a lot of times, this is where microaggressions show up, right? And those little biases.
Yeah.
And this is the things that make people not feel comfortable. And so we just have to do a better job. You said something earlier that I thought was problem, where you were like, I love how much LeBron James posts about wine. Dwayne Wade is starting a winery. And I said to you, and I was like, yeah, it's awesome. And I was like, also though, like, they are millionaires, and we wouldn't never find it weird that any white millionaire drinks wine or engages with wine.
That's true.
We think it's a novelty that these two black millionaires engage with wine. It's like,
well, it's interesting.
It is literally. I mean, there was an article written about it in ESPN about the Banana Boat crew and how, look at these guys. They love wine.
And that's when we know that we don't see black people as whole people.
But
we,
but also. No, yeah, no. It's, I remember seeing it. I was like, why is there an article written about this?
And like to counterpoint that and just speak out of curiosity, though, as we are talking about how there isn't enough people of color in wine, mm-hmm. is there also a sense that like articles like that, that maybe are saying that there is that maybe are inspiring is not the right word, but like is it
saying that it's a I think what we got to do is like figure out how to like not tokenize black people doing regular shit as a way to say look black people do this too, and just like honor the fact that like we're whole people. We do like, yeah, this, we
do
like
also,
wine,
yeah.
We do all types
but,
of
but,
shit.
But I mean, isn't that
but
media...
I don't know if that LeBron James article relates to like the lack of diversity. And when I say diversity, I am specifically talking about numerical representation because people like to use that word diversity a lot. I don't think that that necessarily relates to the other thing because like the reason why it's not that black people don't want to be in wine. It's that there's a lack of opportunities and we have issues in our hiring processes.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
And we, what we were talking about, it's education, but we need opportunity.
There's a lack of opportunities. And what we really do know is that the wine world is very insular. And what that creates is a limited of network. So when you send out a job application, how do you send out the application? How do you make sure it reaches pools of people that are different from you, look different from you, operate different
from
you?
Well, and making sure that you making sure that you are reaching different pools.
Every restaurant I've ever worked at in Los Angeles, the serving community is either college educated or white.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to be a person of color who's serving, 9 times out of 10, they're very educated. And then...
i.e. me.
Everyone else below... is an immigrant.
Right. Yep.
If an immigrant walks in to the door of a restaurant with a resume, it could be the best fucking resume in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The hiring manager, 9 times out of 10, is going to be like, well, we're hiring for a busser or a back waiter.
Yep.
Or,
and this is
without a doubt.
This is why implicit bias in hiring practices has to be the thing that we focus on. Because it's not that there aren't bodies. It's not that, yes, access to education is part. It's a very minuscule part of it. Right. And so because poor white people ain't got no issues getting jobs in this industry.
All I know.
Like,
I never went to college.
Right.
Well, I'm literally the example of that. I didn't go to college. I've never taken a single wine course. I taught myself everything by the internet and stuff. And then I wrote a book and now here, you know, but I know for a fact I would not have been able to get that book deal or be hired by Bon Appetit if I was a uneducated person of color.
And this is my point. So, you know, when you look for that job, did you ask anybody even in your own fucking building if they would ever be interested? Did you empower them to think that that's a position that they could take? Did you say to them?
Did you even ask them if that's something that they want?
Like,
I never understand in restaurants why they don't promote from within.
It drives
me crazy. Like, you've been a back waiter 5 years. You can't be a fucking waiter now?
I mean, but not even that. Like, let's just talk about, like, have you offered those opportunities to people in the back of the house? I hate it when I go to a place and the dishwasher who was the dishwasher 3 years ago is still the dishwasher.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why is that the fucking case?
Well, and that, I think, is a problem not just in hospitality, but in a lot of the industry,
but we just think that we a lot of times, and I've said this, and I know some people aren't going to understand what I'm saying. A lot of times we navigate in ways to be in alignment and closer to power rather than realizing we are powerful. And so we are looking for someone to co-sign on what is right or what could be moving rather than realizing we have the ability and intention to do it ourselves.
And I think on that note, that's a really powerful note to end on this on. And I think the takeaway of this is like, use the power that you have right now.
And everybody has power. There are going to be people right now that say, I don't have power.
In every position that you have right now, whatever your job is, you have power. And if you don't have power in that job, you have agency. And you have power and agency in your personal life, in your social life, and in your community. And we need to be every single one of us needs to be using that power and that agency to be promoting more inclusivity and safer environments. And like, this is, I mean, it's just, and like you said, we are all, right. We have power.
And we have to say safer environments. And I just, and to close it out, we can make environments safer. We can make them healthier. I want to be very clear with everybody. Safe spaces do not exist because we can only control for our behavior. We cannot control for others. But as Adrienne Marie Brown says, what we can do is we can lean into making a braver space by choosing to take a risk and be in community with others.
And look, I just learned something.
Yeah, I learned a lot.
No more. I'm like braver spaces. No, I'm like braver. We're going to be talking to Ashley.
Okay, I know, I could talk
so
about this.
I'm like, this is
have these hard conversations, right? Like, that's the well, thing. Like, the have thing, these hard conversations.
Yeah, but you know what's great? And I like
not that this was a hard conversation.
No, but that's
like,
what I was just about to commend Ashton. Ashton, thank you so much for coming on our podcast and having these hard conversations.
Yes, thank you very, very much.
But having hard conversations and making them approachable and conversational.
Entertaining.
And like and honest and direct. And doing things like I'm fucking telling every single one of you, like, this woman is doing the work, and like, this is one of the biggest ways. And the fact that she's you were able to talk about some of the most complex, important, sometimes controversial, depending on who the audience is, in a way that we literally are sitting in a tiny ass, like, 3-foot space, and we are talking about some serious shit and having a good time together. And thank you for
I was 10% nervous, and now I'm 100% glad that we met
because I really
appreciate it. And
so
yeah,
our next podcast is just gonna be me and Adam like jerking off about how much we love Ashton.
Please don't. All
right, okay. Yeah, I love you. Right. Are you saying don't jerk off about you?
Yeah.